May it please the court, my name is Jay Merle. I represent the remaining sheriff's office defendants, Sheriff Hale, Captain Eddings, and a deputy I'm going to refer to as Deputy Duke. This case is about the district court's decision to deny a motion to dismiss based on qualified immunity with respect to three 1983 claims, excessive force claim against Deputy Duke, and two supervisory liability claims against Sheriff Hale and Captain Eddings, one for excessive force, the other for deliberate indifference to serious medical needs. I'd like to start by talking about the excessive force claim against Deputy Duke. That claim only involves Deputy Duke's second use of his taser. In the appellate's brief, it talks about the first use of the taser not being a constitutional violation. So we're only analyzing the second use of the taser.
Can I get the timeline straight on the second use of the taser? So do I understand correctly, hits him in the left side of the chest initially, then 5 seconds later, Hinkle falls to the floor and wets himself.
Yes.
Then the Deputy Duke, I appreciate that, by the way, Deputy Duke, orders Hinkle to roll over, doesn't move, and then 8 seconds later hits him again.
That's correct.
So is that 8 seconds from first shot to second shot, or are we really talking about 13 seconds and change from first shot to second shot?
According to the complaint, it was 8 seconds between the tasings.
Got it. So tase, fall, urinate, unresponsive, tase again.
And it's clear in the complaint he did not respond to the order. The complaint did not say he could not respond to the order.
Although whether did not, could not, I mean, was he still resisting at that point? Whether it's didn't or couldn't, was he resisting?
Well, at that point, he did not obey an order to roll over to be handcuffed, and it's factored through the terms of what he had done, according to the complaint, seconds beforehand when he had run from another deputy and pulled away from Deputy Duke and the other deputy three times in their effort to grab him. And all of this takes place over a roughly 3-minute span of time, beginning when Deputy Duke did not see the inmate on the video monitor and ending when the nursing staff is called 3 minutes later after the second tase. So it's a tense, uncertain, rapidly evolving situation, something that's not clearly over until the second tase.
Although all of the activity that you describe happens pre-first tase, right? Once he's tased the first time, there's no more activity except him wetting himself.
Wetting himself and then not responding to the order to roll over to be handcuffed. And the order to be roll over to be handcuffed is done after what he had just done with respect to their attempts to physically grab him.
And do you think, especially at 12b-6, that it's a reasonable inference that him having wet himself, which I'll assume is an involuntary bodily function, you can move from didn't respond to couldn't respond, couldn't hold his urine?
Sure. I think the inference at that point can't cut against what's alleged in the complaint. The complaint does not allege that Deputy Duke knew that he could not respond to that order. The complaint does not allege, again, that he could not respond. So we're factoring based on what Deputy Duke knew, and what he knew, according to the complaint, was that he did not respond to the order. So the second tasing is done in an effort to get him to comply with that order. And again, it's happening in a very rapid succession. The district court looked at it from the standpoint of that it was clearly established that you could not use continuous use of force on an inmate who had clearly stopped resisting. Based on these allegations, the resistance was not clearly over when the second tasing was done, because he's still unrestrained and the effort to get him to roll over to be restrained had not been complied with. The case law that talks about the clearly established not being able to use continuous force on an inmate who's clearly stopped resisting deals with situations where inmates had stopped resisting minutes before the force was used, or in situations where the suspect or inmate had not resisted at any point during the encounter with law enforcement. That's not what we have going on here. That's not what these allegations say. We have an unbroken chain of events that happens in very rapid succession, and no case has been cited, and I'm not aware of any case from the 11th Circuit which has held that use of force compressed into roughly an 8-second time frame is somehow unconstitutional when you have an inmate who is not restrained and who, in the effort to get him to roll over to be restrained, is not complied with. The Supreme Court in Kingsley v. Henderson talked about how force is only excessive if it's objectively unreasonable, and it listed factors that can be used to determine whether or not that force is objectively unreasonable. The district court and the plaintiff did not analyze the force under those factors. We did in our brief, and it's submitted. What we are left with is a tense, uncertain situation where the deputy is having to make split-second judgments, and Kingsley recognizes that law enforcement is going to have to make a split-second judgment in a situation when, in view with the 20/20 vision of hindsight, might look different than it looked on the scene.
Well, you know, this tense, uncertain, all that, you know, a lot of times that involves firearms and knives, you know, the guy flailing away at the officers, trying to jerk away. I mean, here you've got clearly an unarmed man. You've got two guards. He's not about to punch out the two officers and run away, is he?
Actually, Judge, he pulled away three times from them.
Well, he pulled away.
Told one of the deputies, Deputy Coden, who's no longer in the case, that he wanted to die. They were taking efforts to move him to a padded cell.
Right.
So you've got an inmate who, after that point, runs away. He is a danger at that point. He's a security situation at that point. It's a situation that is not resolved. And certainly trying to get on top of an inmate at that point with a taser in your hand could lead to a whole host of horribles, leading to injury not only to the inmate, but to the deputies themselves. That is a situation that is classically tense, uncertain.
After the first tase, now Hinkle is laying on the ground, right?
Correct. And he's laying on the ground on his side, Your Honor. That means he can still kick. He can still fight. He is not restrained. And that is the security issue, and that is the issue why he needed to be restrained at that point, which is why Deputy Duke did not follow the first tase by immediately tasing again. He told him to roll over to be handcuffed so they would avoid any further injury, any further disturbance.
Should I be unbothered by the fact that the man wet himself? I mean, it just seems to me that is pretty powerful evidence that he has lost control of his ability to do much of anything.
Your Honor, I think the wetting himself is a fact that obviously is alleged, but it's also alleged that he did not become unresponsive, i.e., unable to respond until after the second tasing. We're based on allegations at this point where Deputy Duke is not alleged to have known that he could not respond to that order. And again, a situation that's ongoing. And Deputy Duke may have made a mistake in his recognition of what was going on, but qualified immunity still covers the mistaken judgment.
Let me ask you about Eddings and Hale, because the district court also denied qualified immunity to them.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any thought one way or the other on the proper propriety of that?
I do, Your Honor. The allegation in that part of the complaint is not that they personally participated in any aspect of what happened to this particular inmate. They are sued as supervisory officials based on policies or customs enacted at the Birmingham jail, with the slight difference that with respect to the deliberate indifference claim, there's also an allegation that the portable defibrillator was not kept with pads. As to the policies and custom allegations, the allegations are that the jail had inadequate policies regarding use of force and inadequate policies regarding medical care. But the complaint doesn't contain any allegations about what happened to any other inmate in any other situation except for this inmate and this situation. And the 11th Circuit has said that to show a policy or custom, you must show a persistent, widespread practice. That's not shown here because there's no allegation about any other inmate, no allegation about any prior conduct, no allegation of any facts which would show Sheriff Hale and Captain Eddings were aware their policies were inadequate and that those inadequate policies were leading to constitutional violations. As to the issue about the portable defibrillator, plaintiff cites no case, and I am not aware of any case that has held that having an inoperable piece of medical equipment has been clearly established to be a constitutional violation. I'm not aware of one that has found it to be a constitutional violation, period. Beyond that, the complaint clearly alleges that after Mr. Hinkle was tased, nursing staff was called, CPR was formed. There's no constitutional right to having a portable defibrillator, but beyond that, he got medical care after the tasing. I'm happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I'll speak in rebuttal.
Mr. Wills.
May I please the court? My name is Todd Wheelis, and we're here today because on September 13th, 2014, Ricky Hinkle died in a pool of his own urine at the Jefferson County Jail in Birmingham, Alabama, after being tased a second time. He was deprived of his medication. He was deprived of treatment for his addiction to alcohol. And as a result of that deprivation and him being tased, he was killed. Now, based
on... Is there any allegation in the complaint, I've forgotten, in which there's an indication they knew about the medication that he's supposed to have and deprived him of it?
Yes, sir. When he was arrested, he was taken to...
What was he arrested for?
I believe public intoxication.
I don't think the complaint says.
I believe public intoxication. He was drunk. He was taken to the Jefferson County Jail in Bessemer, which is another city just to the west of Birmingham. During his the time that he was processed into the jail, they do a medical intake form. During that time, Mr. Hinkle advised him, you know, I'm an alcoholic, I have a problem with alcohol, and I have a problem with some mental health problems, and I take amitriptyline for those issues. So they were aware at the time that he was cycled into the Birmingham Jefferson County Jail on the day one, on September 9th, I believe, that he was supposed to be taking amitriptyline. The next day, he was transferred to downtown facility, which is in Birmingham. There are three claims: the excessive force claim, the supervisory liability claim against Sheriff Hale and the captain that was running the jail, and then the supervisory liability claim against Sheriff Hale and the Captain Eddings for the deliberate indifference to Mr. Hinkle's medical needs. Now, the issue before the court today is simple: whether the appellee alleged sufficient facts to proceed at this stage, at the Rule 12b6 stage. To overcome qualified immunity, we must allege there was a constitutional violation and the constitutional right was clearly established.
So let me ask you, I think I've probably been, I try to be transparent, I think I've been pretty transparent with your opponent about the thing, about his case, about this case that bothers me from his perspective. The thing that bothers me about it from your perspective is that we're charged under Kingsley with looking at six different factors, right? Balancing six factors to determine whether or not this force was excessive. And it is a little hard for me to get my head around the notion that a deputy, Deputy Duke, in the context of an evolving situation, however rapidly or not, but an evolving situation, are we supposed to imagine that he sort of works his way through the six factors and determines that, yeah, excessive force is appropriate here or isn't? That just seems a little fantastical to me.
Well, I think we're given some guidance by several different other cases from the 11th Circuit Court. I stand before you as a former agent with the Alabama Bureau of Investigation, so I am uniquely situated to address use of force issues. I would offer, if you were to lay your hand on that counter up there and I took a hammer and hit your finger, and then I wait 8 seconds, and I hit your finger again with a hammer, does that constitute an unbroken chain of events? I say no. In this case, Deputy Duke tased a half-naked inmate who had on a pair of underwear and had a shower curtain in his hand. He tased him. As a result of that first tasing, he became incapacitated. He urinated on himself, was laying on the floor, not moving. He couldn't respond. He didn't respond, so we tased him again. How could he respond? He had lost control of his faculties.
So your point as to my Kingsley question is, sort of, never mind the six factors, the doctrine. This is one of those sort of obvious clarity cases, the way we describe them. An obvious clarity case. Everybody knows that once you've tased a guy and he's lying in a pool of his own urine, you can't wait 8 seconds and then just decide to tase him again.
Yes, sir. I believe that's absolutely correct. And Judge Toflat wrote an opinion in Fields versus City of Aventura that addresses a very similar issue where a police officer tased an individual. The individual becomes incapacitated on the ground. The police officer approaches him after the guy has given it. He's laying on the ground, not resisting.
he tases him again, and the court held in that case that tasering an individual who is not resisting is not protected by qualified immunity. And that's in the Fields versus City of Aventura, 647 Fed 3rd, 1272. In Danley v. Allen, once a prisoner has stopped resisting, there is no longer a need for force.
Pearson v. Taylor
found found a constitutional violation where a jailer used pepper spray as force against an incapacitated inmate. I think it doesn't matter what, whether it's pepper spray, whether it's a baton, whether it's a taser, whether it's a firearm. If a law enforcement officer, if a deputy sheriff strikes an individual to establish control, that individual gives up and is unresponsive. It is unreasonable and a constitutional violation for that police officer or deputy sheriff 8 seconds later to strike him again or spray him again or shoot him again.
So let me ask you this, because I was going to ask your adversary the same question. We've got cases. I was looking at a case in my notes called Glassox versus Argo, a recent case summarizing earlier cases. Together, it says Smith versus Maddox and Oliver versus Fiorino clearly established that the repeated tasing of a subdued arrestee who has ceased any resistance or threatening conduct is excessive force. But I think I heard him say, sort of in anticipation, imagining that I might be asking that question, to say, yeah, but those cases are where the guy is non-resistant for minutes. It's not just 8 seconds. He says, those are cases where the guy, I don't remember the facts of the cases, but he's out, compliant for minutes. And this is different because here, 8 seconds, it is long, the dramatic pause here, but it's not as long as minutes. What do you say to that?
What I say to that is, did Deputy Duke or the other deputy, as Mr. Hinkle is laying on the floor in a pool of his own urine, motionless, is there a threat to them when he's laying there motionless? Whether it's for 2 seconds or 5 seconds or 8 seconds or 2 minutes, there is no longer a threat to those deputy sheriffs as he's laying there motionless in a pool of his own urine.
So you think really if this were a 2 second case, it'd be the same case?
I don't know, sir. That may have been a poor use of 2 seconds, but 8 seconds, a trained law enforcement officer, a deputy sheriff who has been trained and been through a taser program, he understands and has been trained on the law. He understands you cannot tase an inmate that is not resisting. And we think it's a clear case of that.
Was he resisting by simply not carrying out his command to roll over to be handcuffed? Is that the kind of resisting?
Well, that's the argument that the defendants are making, sir, Judge. And we would, in response to that, we would say, was he capable of responding? Was he capable? Was the observation that was being made by the deputy, he had lost control of his ability. He couldn't pee on himself after he got tased. Did he have the ability to move? Did he have the ability to even understand what's being told him? Is he's giving orders, roll over, show it, give us your hands. Did he even have the capacity? Did they give him enough time to comply after being tased? And I think the total, and Judge Newsom was very astute, I think when he was tased, there's a 5 second cycle. He's tased for 5 seconds, electricity sent through his body. Then there's an 8 second pause until he's tased again. So from the beginning of the first tase to the beginning of the second tase was 13 seconds.
Well, I thought your opposing counsel said no, it was only 8 seconds between the two tasings.
Yes, sir. Between the two tases, there are 8 seconds.
Between the end of the first and the beginning of the second. So the first tase is for 5 seconds like this. I mean, maybe I'm not doing a very good tase, but this is how I imagine it happening.
I believe that's probably pretty accurate. I think it's 5 seconds of, you're being shot for 5 seconds. The electricity terminates. Then there's an 8 second pause. During those 8 seconds, he had fallen to the ground. He had urinated on himself, and he's just laying there motionless. On the ground, motionless. And then they tase him again. We think that constitutes a violation of his constitutional rights. And the district court found that as well.
What's your position about Eddings and Hale? I mean, there are no other instances of alleged excessive force or deliberate indifference, are there, in your complaint?
No, sir, not in our complaint. Now, the defense counsel said it has to be a policy or custom. One way to prove it is a policy or custom of this type of behavior, this type of ongoing pattern in practice. There's another way that you can show it, and that's through a causal connection between the supervisor's actions and the constitutional deprivation. Now, I'm referring to Matthews v. Crosby. Now, the casual connection rule can be established when it's alleged that a supervisor's customer policy results in deliberate indifference to constitutional rights, and that's out of the Matthews v. Crosby case. Here, the district court found that we alleged that the appellee alleged in detailed factual predicate that A. Helling Eddings failed to create, adopt, and implement rules regarding appropriate use of force. B, that failure constitutes a deliberate indifference to consequences of excessive force. And C, Mr. Hinkle's death was foreseeable of that as a result of that failure to adopt those policies and procedures. So we can survive at this stage by alleging that causal connection between the acts that took place and the failure to institute or implement those policies or procedures that would prevent that.
So I thought for custom or policy liability, you had to show incidents not involving this specific person. Like, it's not like a lot of stuff that happened to this guy. It's like this has happened before to other people, and thus these people, the supervisors, were on notice. And it seems like here all of the allegations are about your guy.
Well, we believe at the motion to dismiss stage, Your Honor, that the causal connection argument that we made and the way that we pled it in the complaint gets us over that hurdle at the 12B. State.
Well, it's on summary judgment. Probably you'd lose the point if there were no other episodes.
Yes, sir.
If we the double tasing thing turned out to be not policy at all.
Yes, sir. We believe we should be allowed to do discovery on it and see if we can proceed on that claim.
Although I must say that it struck me that the district court's analysis of the supervisory liability issue of Hale and Eddings is relatively weak. It's all in one paragraph on page 5. And that's it. I mean, he didn't do any extensive analysis at all on that point. Okay.
And under the third claim of supervisory liability claim against Sheriff L. and Captain Eddings for the deliberate indifference to medical needs, the analysis here that we allege that Mr. Hinkle was deprived of the amitriptyline, which I think that's he was. Mr. Hinkle was deprived of treatment for alcohol withdrawal, which is a clear constitutional violation. Many, many cases in the 11th Circuit hold that. Mr. Hinkle was deprived of an AED.
Then your argument is you alleged enough to show that was the policy.
Yes, sir.
Not to give any medication, I suppose. Rather than these specific items,
yes,
the policy would have to be we just don't medicate alcoholics.
It appears that would be the policy, sir.
Of course, he didn't deny the medication for 5 days, and that's what caused him to die. I mean, you know, the medication was not the cause of his death. It was presumably the tasing and cardiac arrest resulting from that, wasn't it?
Well, Judge, we allege that as a result of him being withheld the amitriptyline, he began having some type of episode. And I think that the allegations are that he began being loud and boisterous and would not cooperate with the deputies. There wasn't a history of him doing that in the 4 or 5 days he had been incarcerated. It just started. We believe that we can show that by withholding the amitriptyline, he began acting in a manner he wouldn't have if he'd had his medication.
The complaint doesn't allege that he was deprived one way or the other about the medication up to this episode, does it?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
It's just silent.
So, yes, sir.
I mean, the allegation is they don't medicate alcoholics. That's basically what your point is.
Well, we know that they didn't medicate Mr. Hinkle, and they withheld him. But to further, the rule is an official acts with deliberate indifference when he intentionally delays providing an inmate with access to medical treatment, knowing that the inmate has a life-threatening condition or an urgent medical condition. It would be exacerbated by delay. That's from the Bozeman v. Orem case. Here, we know Mr. Hinkle suffered from alcoholism. We know he was on medication for depression, the amitriptyline. He began exhibiting delusional behavior immediately before this event with Deputy Duke. And as after he got tased, there were no AED pads at the facility. Jail officials did nothing. Now, in the Lancaster v. Monroe County case, clearly the 11th Circuit found that failure to provide medical treatment to an inmate going through alcohol withdrawal was a deliberate indifference to a serious medical need, and it clearly established a constitutional violation.
I think we have your point.
Briefly, Your Honors, the comparison was made or attempted to be made between the event involving Deputy Duke and certain other cases, I think Phil's, Danley, and Pearson. In Phil's, it was a situation where there was no alleged resistance at all at any point during the encounter. During Danley, that was the situation where an inmate was pepper sprayed. The pepper spray itself was found to be constitutional. The problem was leaving the inmate in an, I guess, a cell, fully ventilated cell for 20 minutes after that and not allowing the inmate to shower off. That was the constitutional violation. That was the force. In the Pearson case, which is an unpublished opinion from the 11th Circuit, the inmate was hit with a 60-second blast of pepper spray. The inmate passes out for 5 minutes. He wakes up. He tells the guard, "I'm having trouble breathing. He's incoherent." The guard responds by popping him again with another 60-second blast of pepper spray. Totally different situation than what's alleged to have happened here. In terms of the policies at the jail, the allegation was not that there was a policy of not providing care for alcoholics or not providing medication to alcoholics. The complaint said the decision to deny those things was based on inadequate jailer training, poorly trained corrections officers making treatment decisions, or other inadequacies in the policy. There was no affirmative policy alleged to prohibit those things, which gets us back to you have to be able to show, at least in terms of the causal connection, more than just this particular incident. You've got to show that it was occurring at least with some degree of regularity.
So I have a question about that, even though I'm the one that sort of threw this stink bomb into the room. How exactly would a plaintiff be able to make that showing in a complaint without discovery? I mean, how could you even allege that consistent with Rule 11 unless it was just word of mouth, kind of grapevine?
Yeah, at this point, Judge, I don't think you can make that allegation. But of course, the way the case will unfold, there are multiple defendants in this case, some of whom have not been let go, some of whom are still in the case. After the case is ongoing, you can certainly send a subpoena request to the sheriff's office for certain information.
No, I guess what I mean is you won this case at 12b-6. And in part, you're saying on the supervisory liability claims, it was right that we won because the plaintiffs couldn't show, as to custom and policy, that this had happened a bunch of times before. Sure. It's not just their guy. And I'm just wondering, how would they know to allege multiple incidents without discovery?
Well, certainly pre-discovery investigation, that's what appears to happen in the cases where there are allegations, where you have allegations of multiple complaints, or they're basing it on previous lawsuits against the particular entity where the entity was found to have violated.
How would they do pre-discovery? How would they discover prior to the lawsuit?
Well, grapevine or chain of
events. Oh, well, I mean,
in those cases, Your Honor, where they're alleged.
Well, it would seem to me, let's assume that they made a flat out allegation there was a policy of not medicating alcoholics.
Sure.
Flat out. I would think for purposes of 12b-6, you would need to show other episodes involving alcoholics.
Correct, Your Honor.
They just blame. They might not be able to prove it, but that's
right. But they have not made.
Well, and they would say that in this case, the policy was executed. They didn't do a thing.
Correct. Correct. But at this point, Your Honor, we think the sheriff's defendants are entitled to qualified immunity based on these allegations. The district court's decision should be reversed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Court will be adjourned under the usual order.
All rise.